This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Vanity Fair.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
I am delighted and proud to introduce him as Academy Award winner.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
The winner, it's a tie.
And any little girl who's practicing their speech on the telly, you never know.
Mom, I just want an Oscar.
I am Katie Rich. I'm here with a stacked full house today. I'm here with Richard Lawson.
Hello.
With David Canfield.
Hi.
With Kara Warner.
Hello.
With an old friend named Rebecca Ford.
Hello, I'm back.
Oh my God.
Briefly.
For now. Back briefly.
Now.
And we're all here because we have the most exciting task of the year. And for that, we bring in our friend Joe Reed.
Hi.
If Joe's here and it is after the Oscars, it means it is time to predict the 2025 Oscar winners. Well, really, I mean, we say winners. We never actually get that far. We predict the movies we'll be talking about in a year. Rebecca, you have come back for this very special task. Having been on maternity leave for this entire back half of award season, how do you feel ready to look this far in the future already?
In school, I was the kid who like always did the group project for everyone. And now I'm the exact opposite. I'm the kid who's coming in having done no research or homework. But maybe it'll lead to success because the research way hasn't worked for any of us before.
We all look upon this spreadsheet that Joe makes and try to get out our crystal balls and more often than not send ourselves on wild tangents, especially when we try to predict the winner of Best Picture, which, Kara, I didn't tell you enough in advance that you're going to have to do this. So hopefully you got your pencils out and ready for the end of this episode.
Yes.
So we start, before we get into next year's predictions, by looking back at this experiment that we did last year. And Brett, as always, has pulled up some clips of our past selves where we will hear just how right and wrong we got things. So let's get started by flashing back to March of 2023 and see how we did.
I will be honest, now that we've had 2 years in a row of, especially in the Best Picture race, preferences for less weight on noted iconic filmmakers, I'm a little cooler on its Best Picture chances, at least for a win. But this still feels like a huge play for Apple.
David, do you know what you're talking about?
I didn't until it said Apple at the end.
He's talking about Ghosted.
So we started with that because you had predicted Killers of the Flower Moon as your 2023 Best Picture, you know, whatever. It got delayed for a while. It didn't premiere till last year. So that's where we started the conversation. But I liked that part of it because I think you were completely right in terms of how it was treated as a major film, but not a winning film. It was a good nuance you caught very early.
Although I will say that they did revert, the Academy did revert a little bit in terms of recognizing a more traditional contender. It just was not Killers of the Flower Moon. But yeah, I think... the more that movie was delayed and the more we waited for it, I think it became clear, or just maybe we remembered, that Martin Scorsese's Oscars track record has always been a little bit spotty when it comes to wins. And this one was not going to be on the side of the winners, let's say.
We did talk about Lily Gladstone. I think we were very aware that she was a narrative from the very start. At the point we recorded this, I think we knew it was headed for Cannes. It does make it kind of feel like Killers of the Flower Moon getting a bunch of Oscar nominations and winning nothing was a, faded from the very beginning. It didn't feel that way, but it's interesting to see it from that context. We started talking about apples. We mentioned Napoleon as well. I just want to give us credit that it did wind up with some Oscar nominations, although Ridley Scott's lack of an Oscar continues for another year. And then we did the smart thing, which we hadn't done the year before, and focus on early in the year films, because we infamously in 2022 didn't talk about Everything Everywhere All at Once. So you guys might be able to guess where we started by talking about early year films, but let's go to that one next.
It's amazing. It was the movie of Sundance. Incredible performances, incredible writing and directing from a first-time filmmaker. I hope that A24 can figure out. I mean, it's a much gentler, smaller, more delicate movie than Everything Everywhere, so it's a different kind of campaign you'd have to run.
Is it like an After Sun, or is it
It's a little bit more. It feels a little bit bigger than After Sun, but not much.
Yeah, it's got a bit more sweep, I think.
I didn't really mean to make this a puzzle, but Richard, you know what you're talking about.
I wish I had the 2023 Sundance lineup in my head ready to go so I could make some joke. But no, it's Past Lives, obviously.
Yeah.
And it was a little bit bigger. It got more nominations one more nomination.
Double the nominations. Yeah.
But not an acting nomination, sadly.
Yeah, David, you actually... pointed out it should be in the Best Picture 10 and the Screenplay 5, and that the question was about Greta Lee. And then you also compared it to Women Talking, which it got the exact nominations of Women Talking. So well done there.
Yeah. I think if I remember correctly, I had brought up Brooklyn 2 in comparison to that movie at the time. And that is a movie that obviously did get a Best Actress nomination for Saoirse Ronan. But I think it's had a similar Sundance trajectory as a romance with a little bit more heft, still very much on an indie scale, that was able to last for a very long time.
Rebecca, you were such a champion of Past Lives for so long. You talked to Celine Song in this podcast right back when it came out, but you haven't chimed in since the Oscars happened. So do you feel like it was a disappointment that Past Lives didn't win any Oscars, or have you made peace with it?
I think I'm saddest about Greta Lee. I thought it was such a wonderful performance and such a big moment for her, but I'm not too worried about everyone. I feel like we're going to see a lot of really exciting stuff from them. It opened a lot of doors for both Celine Song and Greta Lee. So, I there's lots of things I was sad about this Oscars that I haven't gotten to talk about, and I'm still recovering. But I feel like the future's bright for everyone involved with that movie. So I'm looking at it as glass half full.
I feel like at the very least, Greta Lee and Charles Melton together on our cover, like talking to each other in those videos and being incredibly charming, like both of them got some boost from that didn't come from the Oscar nominations.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
Okay, back to the flashbacks. Joe, I think you were the person talking in this next clip.
Okay. I have my eye on Sean Durkin's new movie, The Iron Claw, one of these years.
Yes.
I feel like Sean Durkin is going to break through to the Oscars. He keeps making really good movies.
Still waiting.
Joe, what happened with Iron Claw? I feel like we tried to solve this puzzle in real time and never did crack it.
It opened so late. I think some movies can sort of make that work for them. And I think because a lot of the success story of The Iron Claw did end up being how much money it ended up making for A24 relative to what A24's movies tend to do, then that might have been a nice boost for it. Now, does it make that much money if it opens earlier in the year? Maybe not. Maybe it, you know, benefits from the holiday traffic, so you can't really tell. But this was maybe a movie that people needed to have a little bit more time to find and to champion. And by the time it opened, it felt like the awards lineup had kind of calcified a little bit, that we had our long lists and Iron Claw wasn't on it. It didn't play any festivals. And there was a sense that there was this good movie waiting, but nobody had seen it. And I don't know. I think it's too bad. I still think it's going to happen for Sean Durkin at some point. I think this was a good step forward for him and a nice, you know, step forward for somebody like Jeremy Allen White into the movies from television. I thought Harris Dickinson showed up very well, and obviously Zac Efron. It was a really good movie. So at least there was that. At least it wasn't some, you know, horrible bomb that I was championing a year ahead of time. So
do we know what Sean Durkin has up next? Has he announced anything? I don't think he's on our 2024 list, at least.
Mm-mm.
No, I don't think he has anything quite so soon.
I mean, given how long it was between The Nest and Martha Marcy, I worry we'll be waiting a very long time, but hopefully the success of Iron Claw will help us there a little bit.
Worth noting, though, that A24 was the only studio to get two Best Picture nominations this past season. So they did have a full plate. And I don't know that they really could have gone much further with that movie, even if it was released earlier. Release it when they did because it wasn't finished. So I think they probably got out of it what they were hoping with the box office.
That's fair. Yeah, that's fair.
We were very fixated on A24 when we did this because, again, they had just won Best Picture. So we stuck with them for the next set of predictions that we made.
Two A24 movies that I would highlight, given that they brought Aronofsky back to the Oscars in a way for the first time in a few movies, interested in Sofia Coppola's Priscilla, especially post-Elvis, already Sundance premiere, You Hurt My Feelings, which I'm just still waiting for. A Nicole Hofstetter movie, she was nominated for writing for Can You Ever Forgive Me, to have an Academy moment.
You know, for all the attention Greta Gerwig got for not getting a Best Director nomination, two more female filmmakers who make great movies who did not get the Oscar buzz that they deserved, I think.
David, you were full of so much hope in that clip.
I really was. I do not remember talking about You Hurt My Feelings in that context, much as I loved that movie. The Priscilla case is another interesting one for A24 of an improbably commercially successful Sofia Coppola movie. Maybe not so improbably given the subject, but I just found no awards traction whatsoever. Didn't even get any Indie Spirit nominations from what I remember. And yet it worked out for them okay. Won a big award at Venice. And it was, I think, Coppola's biggest hit since Lost in Translation.
Yeah, it does feel like she's now queued up for a bigger awards return, if that is the direction that she wants to go in. Like, you know, The Beguiled got like so thoroughly ignored by awards. This got a little bit further. It kind of feels like a pendulum swinging back toward her. Okay, we're going to stick on the future of this had Oscar buzz movies topic for you, Joe, with our next flashback clip.
Saltburn is a really, really anticipated title, given that it's from Emerald Fennell, who won Best Original Screenplay for Promising Young Woman, a Sundance debut that went a very, very long way. And this one has Rosamund Pike and Jacob Elordi, and who is also in Priscilla as Elvis. So he's an interesting one to watch this year.
I want to note, this is the only Saltburn discussion. We just immediately moved on from it. We had no idea how important it was going to be for the discourse going forward.
I feel like we knew so little about it at that point last year, where, you know, in terms of what kind of movie it was going to be, what kind of tone it would have, and even who was sort of the featured, you know, actor in it. Was this more, I remember at least thinking, oh, this is like a Rosamund Pike vehicle that Emerald Fennell has queued up. Yeah, little did we know it would be the lightning rod of controversy, apparently, and
memes. Don't forget the memes.
Well, sure, yeah. I mean, which I think contributes to, I think without the memes, I think this movie is maybe not nearly as hated as it was in the corners that hated this movie. I think there was a lot of pushback to the memification of this movie, that this was in people's faces for so long, and if you didn't like it, that was probably irksome. And I don't know, I really liked it as pushing it, but like, I enjoyed, Katie, you were there, we both saw it together.
Oh yeah, we yelled about it walking down the streets of New York City.
We had a good old time. Yeah.
It was a great one to like yell at the screen while you're watching. I had a great time being like, oh no.
Not that song. That song wasn't around then.
Which is probably why it didn't get the Oscar nominations, but we might continue talking about it more than many of the actual Oscar nominees.
Uh-huh. Yep.
Absolutely.
Well, we were talking about Emerald Fennell, I guess, and talked about previous winners returning to the Oscars, and then Joe, you jumped in with this one.
I mean, not a winner, sort of famously not a winner yet, but I feel like Maestro is the other sort of big heavy hitter this year to take a look at. Maybe that's our intro into the Netflix conversation, because they have a lot on their roster that could open this year.
And it went so well.
Oh, dear. If we thought he was famously not a winner then, my God.
I'm like saying. Yeah.
I mean, we were right. That Maestro did get a ton of nominations. So, and it was talked about a lot. So
it did.
Yeah.
I do like the way that the worm turned on Bradley Cooper in the past year. I don't think I really realized until we listened back to this, because we were also high on A Star Is Born. I think that like kind of overblown, I think, criticism that came his way was really not a glimmer in our eye back then.
Yeah.
I don't know. I feel like the Maestro trajectory is going to be like a weird case study in a few years, because just seems like a really, I was surprised too with how things turned on him sort of through the season.
I think Maestro was kind of a perfect storm for Cooper in terms of frustration. I think there were people who, you know, didn't like the movie. I think there were people who found his approach to promoting the movie, where he was sort of both ingratiating himself and distancing himself at the same time, which feels like not quite playing with a standard deck. And then also, like, he's very sincere about a lot of things, and it can come across in a way where it's like you just want to sort of like give him a noogie or something like that. I don't know. Just like,
oh, that's nice.
You know,
didn't this all sort of happen with Star Is Born too? Like there was a point, you know, at the gate, it was so celebrated. And then as the campaign went on,
it was much more towards Gaga, like in her little, little phrase that she used all season. That 100
people
in
a room.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep.
Like, yeah. Bradley could have used Carrie to be a little bit more extra on the campaign trail and maybe take some of the heat off of them.
She put it all into Saltburn. All her extraness is in that one performance. Right.
All she did was give us the slow clap at the BAFTAs. And that was it. I think that the other, you know, dynamic with this movie is it's a far weirder and less conventional movie than I think the marketing suggested. And then I think a Netflix release would suggest, and we could talk about May, December too. Like if you look at audience scores or Letterboxd scores for this movie, they're quite low. And it was never, I think, in that right lane of being really, really art house, but it had all these resources behind it, and it had Bradley Cooper. And so it was given this kind of mainstream sheen that just created, a real disconnect.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
I'm going to skip ahead a little bit in the clips we've selected, because we did talk about Rustin immediately after this on the Netflix topic as a Best Actor nominee potential. That came true. Congratulations to us. And then we talked about Fair Play, which had just been picked up from Sundance. Yeah. And Richard kind of suggested it as a potential push for a screenplay nomination. And then I think that led us into our next topic. If we can skip one over one clip and go to this one, Brett.
That is an increasingly tough needle to thread these years, too, with like a screenplay contender that is not necessarily a Best Picture contender. Like those slots tend to really get swallowed up by those bigger, all categories contenders, which to me is a little bit of a shame, because there are movies that it's just like you look at a movie and like, oh, that should be a screenplay nominee, like regardless of anything else, like that should be a screenplay nominee. So I'm excited to see that movie, though.
I'm also excited. This is not a Netflix movie, so I'm sorry to change the topic. But like, I did the Oscar recap of the 20 years ago Oscars, and there was Julianne Moore for Far From Heaven, the Todd Haynes movie. And this year, Julianne Moore has another Todd Haynes movie coming out called May, December. Not a Netflix movie, but...
And we were just talking about Soul screenplay nominees. Richard, you just predicted the future in an incredible way.
I know, I'm the best at this. That's right. obviously I did not know at the time that Netflix was going to buy the movie out of Cannes. I think that, you know, Netflix did a lot for that movie. Maybe it wasn't campaigned as hard as some of their other titles, but I think, you know, we know on this podcast, and anyone who follows the Oscars knows that, like, you cannot ever really bet on Todd Haynes movies, like, mm-hmm. you know, going all the way at the Oscars.
Yeah.
But I did think, based on the Julianne Moore, the Natalie Portman of it all, I thought that those two actors would be way more in the acting conversation than they were. They dropped out of, like, any kind of serious, like, talk of contenders very early. I mean, mostly because Melton, you know, came along and sort of stole the focus in a way, which I'm sure that Moore and Portman were perfectly fine with. But, like, yeah. I don't know. It's just weird that, like, Natalie Portman was not really... I don't feel like people were seriously considering her as a potential Best Actress nominee as early as, like, November.
Yep. Even as sort of crowded as Best Actress was this year with very, very good contenders, I still feel sort of raw about that. I do think Portman was giving such a strong performance, and it feels like there are other actresses who give that kind of performance and are maybe more of an automatic, you know, well, slot them in to the Oscar lineup, and for some reason she was not afforded that. And I think with the Julianne Moore thing, I think part of it is she is a lead, you know what I mean? Like, she is, she's a co-lead of that movie, at least I thought. But I think you're right to mention the fact that, like, Charles Melton really was sort of getting every bit of precursor award attention. And then for the Oscars to go around and yank that away from him too, it seemed unfair. I don't know.
What more could Natalie Portman have done? You know what I mean? She gives this incredible performance, and then she does the award stuff, the nonsense that she has to do. And it's like, I don't know. I agree with this film. It just felt incredibly frustrating.
Looked amazing on the cover of your magazine. I mean, my goodness.
I said this before, that, you know, the news of her divorce being final came out right after the Oscars. The fact that she did a full court awards push and never had to talk about that. I mean, that's maybe more about her, like, team around her. But she threaded that needle and still couldn't get there.
So what happens when you start acting in, like, 4 or whatever?
you know how to
move around that stuff.
Well, David, you got to hang out at the Oscars with May December Soul nominees Sammy Birch and Alex Mechanic, so you were at least there in the grand finale.
And they were in great spirits. They had a great time this season. And in the end, I think Netflix did right by this movie. They did push it really hard. Those actors were everywhere once the strike ended. It was gratifying to me to get to see a Todd Haynes movie get that kind of push. Even though, as Richard said, we can never count on the industry actually embracing a great Todd Haynes movie. It just does not happen.
Okay, I think we moved on from there to another director who we spent a lot of time talking about this season. Two quote-unquote overdue directors. We can debate how much they are that I want to mention. David Fincher back at Netflix with The Killer with Michael Fassbender as an assassin. It's kind of hard to tell where that is Oscar-y. And then Alexander Payne has a movie coming out with Paul Giamatti. That's a valuable reunion.
I think he is kind of due for that. He makes movies with a lot of heart. It has an interesting cast combo of Paul Giamatti, who is a beloved, long veteran actor, and someone like Divine Joy Randolph, who is the co-lead in this movie, and who is a phenomenal actor, who is just waiting for that first Oscar nomination. And this feels like a really big, fun role that she can sink her teeth into.
Well, then
I'll take that one.
I mean, David, to spoil the end of this, you predicted The Holdovers to win Best Picture, and you stood by it for a long time, admirably, I think.
I did. Even when the writing was on the wall for Oppenheimer, I probably would not have stuck with The Holdovers as long as I did had I not, you know, predicted it so early. But it does check a lot of boxes. And I think in another year, say a CODA year, it could have easily been a Best Picture winner. But yeah, Divine Joy Randolph, I remember the moment that casting notice came out a couple years ago, I was like, first Oscar nomination incoming. And obviously we got that and then some.
But is the movie cozy, David?
Can we roll back to the Alexander Payne tape, Katie?
We're bringing up our award season PTSD already, Rebecca. It's too soon.
She's coming in to throw chaos.
I'm going to confess, I don't know what this next clip is about because I didn't give myself good enough notes. So, Brett, surprise us all.
I don't know if this movie is going to be big or small or whatever, but Annette Bening still doesn't have an Oscar. And so it's my responsibility to get out there that she's going to be in a movie called Naiad, where she plays a real life 64-year-old marathon swimmer who attempted to become the first person to ever swim, I believe, unassisted from Cuba to Florida. And that just feels like there are some elements there, right? Wow, a previous version of myself who didn't know who Diana Nyad was.
I love how uncertain you are, and you didn't know about the jellyfish yet. You're so innocent.
I didn't know any of it. Like, certainly, both Charlize and I were very much unaware of the jellyfish at this point. So.
Joe, you said there were some elements there, and you're right. The element was water.
The element H2O was exactly what I was
thinking. You hadn't seen Elemental yet. You hadn't put it all together.
So in the end, was Nyad big or small or somewhere
That's
in the middle?
That's a good question. That's a very good question. Was Nyad big or small? Big enough to get two acting nominations, which good for that movie. Nyad, not as bad as you've heard, not as good as you want it to be. I feel like that's sort of where Nyad ended up hitting.
I do sadly envision, though, like 40 years from now, the younger, you know, who our replacements in this Oscar fascination, looking at whatever new Wikipedia exists and being like, what's Nyad? You know, like, I know who those two actors are, but what is this movie they were both nominated for?
I don't know. It was a nice addition to the campaigns of last year, you know, and it forged a real friendship between Annette and Jodie, right? So, like, I think
that's true.
Thank you. Thank you, Kara.
Yeah. I mean, the picture of Jodie Foster and Robert De Niro hugging as Oscar nominees this year, like, you just I wouldn't trade that for anything.
Jodie Foster getting back into the Oscar conversation after how many years since her last nomination? Yeah. Like, that was worth it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I believe this next clip will keep us on the best actress topic, if I remember correctly. Let's roll it. We mentioned Searchlight already in that they have Magazine Dream, so they have a couple of other interesting things. They have the Yorgos Lanthimos movie, Poor Things, which we talked about last year, especially the fact that Willem Dafoe's in there and keeps getting Oscar nominations. Gerard Carmichael, who had a really interesting year last year.
I think he's one of my favorite filmmakers, and he's also like an incredible craftsman, so we can just assume that this film is going to look beautiful when it comes to production design and costume and everything. I mean, will it be too, like, Lobster is probably my favorite of his movies, but will this be too weird for the Oscars? Does that exist anymore? I don't know, but I'm definitely excited for it.
You nailed it, Rebecca.
Wow. Not production design, costume, you were calling out categories. This is great.
It's surprising that it wasn't too weird still, I think.
Yeah.
Because, Rebecca, you saw it really early. I don't know if you'd seen it when we recorded this. But
Rebecca and I saw that together, actually.
Oh, yeah, we did. Yeah. That's right. And it was either around the time of this recording. I think maybe I'd seen it. And
I think you'd seen it.
Yeah. And I did walk out being like, it's great, but it's too weird for them. And I was wrong.
I felt the exact same way. Yeah. It was like, oh, this is, I cannot see the Academy voting for this.
I wonder what would have happened with that movie if it came out as scheduled. It was scheduled for right before TIFF.
Or during TIFF, I feel like.
During
TIFF, like early September, yeah.
And I just think its trajectory would have been totally different.
Yeah.
Because I also think people just were going to go into it with a different mindset. It felt like a burn-off date. Obviously, it was anything but that. But it is fascinating the way I do think that the strike really worked to that movie's benefit in terms of campaigning. Mm-hmm. It just all crested at the right moment.
Yeah, Joe, I know you have feelings about that from the movie Fantasy League and Poor Things.
Oh, definitely. I mean, at least it stayed in the season. At least we didn't have to pull it from the lineup like Dune 2 and well, Challengers was before. Challengers at least pulled out before the league started. So there was that.
But you also had it kind of at a low cost because of that release date.
Oh, that's true. I had underpriced it because we thought it was a burn-off September movie. Yeah.
Four Oscars later. Look how wrong we were.
Indeed.
Let's stick with Searchlight for this next one.
Feels like Andrew Hay is kind of due for a broader awards play. 45 years, most notably, got Charlotte Rampling an overdue Oscar nomination. But he's been making great movies for a number of years now, and he also made Looking, which was very underrated on HBO. But, you know, I think that this film has many elements, if it comes together in a way that, again, is not too weird, that could really play.
I knew that was coming.
Andrew Hay and Sean Durkin just team up somehow and fix this.
This was back when it was just strangers, right? We were...
Yes.
Yeah.
Based on the novel.
Was it too weird for Oscar? Is that part of the problem we were looking at with this movie?
No, I think it was a little too small. I mean, I don't think it's ultimately that weird of a movie if you know the conceit, which I think the campaign eventually did a good job of establishing. But this was a really strong year for Best Picture nominees, to the point where Past Lives was really kind of holding down that indie fort in that top 10. And I just don't think the movie had enough, you know, enough of that scope to go as far as I would have hoped it would have. That said, I remain like just confused and sad that Andrew Scott couldn't even get a BAFTA nomination. I think that the campaign there was very clear and the lane was very doable in that. So that remains a bummer for me.
Sort of like Greta Lee, though, is that Andrew Scott was in this sort of ecosystem all season. His name, you know, is now sort of, you know, better known. He was at the Golden Globes, and I think his profile definitely got raised. I think he's no longer Hot Priest, which is all I've ever wanted for the last several years, that people would recognize the fact that it's not just Hot Priest in his career. So grateful for that.
Okay, this next week we have is a fun one.
Speaking of the weirdness of Yorgos Lanthimos, there's the weirdness of Jonathan Glazer potentially gifting us with something. You know, he did Under the Skin and Birth, and he's just a really singular filmmaker who doesn't make a lot. He doesn't make movies often. He has a movie called The Zone of Interest, which I don't know much about. I guess it's A24, but it's about a Nazi officer falling in love with, I guess, the wife of someone else at Auschwitz. I mean, so it's Nazis in love, which, like, ugh. That's what the book is about.
I was going to say, that's more describing the book. Yeah, so.
Let us all pause in gratitude that it wasn't about that, at least.
Rebecca, weren't you going in expecting, like, a love triangle movie?
I did not realize this is Richard's fault that I went into Cannes being like, oh, I'm going to go watch this.
This explains
Nazi
the mystery, because I remember
it's
you
Martin
came out
Amos's
of that movie.
Fault.
Exactly.
It is Martin Amos.
Blame Martin Amos. Yeah, what all we had was to go off was that he was making a movie based on that book. And having read the book for our book club, like, the book also isn't about a love triangle.
No, it's
not. That's part of it. Like, there is an affair that happens in it. But it seems that Glazer took the setting and the title and some of the themes and then did his own thing, and it paid off.
I mean, who would have expected that a week and a half after the Oscars, Jonathan Glazer is the winner that is getting the most discussed? I don't know if anyone really want to get into it, but, you know, Jonathan Glazer finally has an Oscar, but is he enjoying it? I hope he gets there someday.
I do think it speaks to the unique place that movie held all season for people who may not have understood where Jonathan Glazer was coming from, but still embraced the movie, let's say.
Yeah.
And so we're left with a disconnect within Hollywood that is kind of fascinating and disturbing to watch play out.
Well, and The Zone of Interest, like Priscilla and Iron Claw, made some money for A24. I guess probably not quite the same level of profit, but it was a hit by some standard. Okay, this next clip is about a minute long, but it's worth it. So let's kick this off.
Obviously, sort of famously, Oppenheimer and Barbie are both opening on the same weekend. Christopher Nolan and Greta Gerwig are both filmmakers who have had great Oscar success, especially as of late with Nolan. And obviously, Greta Gerwig has gotten Best Picture nominations for both Lady Bird and Little Women. Barbie definitely does not, on the surface, seem like an Oscar movie. But again, if the theme is, you know, nothing isn't an Oscar movie now, there's a world in which I could see if Margot Robbie is giving a very stylized and sort of high wire comedic performance in that movie, I could absolutely see that getting an awards push. And I think Oppenheimer, if it doesn't bomb, like the commercial prospects of that movie fascinate me. Well, God, I didn't even do that on purpose. Oh, Lord. If Oppenheimer doesn't, ignite, no, that's the wrong word, too. Okay.
If there's not a big mushroom cloud surrounding Oppenheimer.
But, like, I'll be interested to see what kind of crowds flock to see a movie with that premise and that title. But, like, it does look, just from the trailer, absolutely amazing. And whether Cillian Murphy finally gets, some Oscar attention.
Well, Joe, you did kind of explain it all.
I did, although, like, listening back, I really did underestimate the box office potential for both. I was still very much on the side of, you know, Christopher Nolan's making a movie about a nuclear scientist. Are people going to really, you know, go to see that? Is Barbie going to be ultimately too, you know, sort of light and fluffy for Oscar? I think I still managed to underestimate both of those movies in significant ways.
You weren't the only one, actually. We have one more bonus clip from this. We talked about them for a while, but there's one more thing I couldn't resist putting in there.
If it's just a bunch of artfully filmed explosions and then men talking in rooms, that might be tough for a summer movie-going crowd.
And I was right.
You were right. You did nail exactly what Oppenheimer is about.
And you're talking about Ghosted, right?
No, that's for next year's prediction somehow. No, I mean, we did kind of get the Barbie-Oppenheimer combo. I guess even at that point, you know, the memes about them had started already. But, no, Joe, I think we all underestimated. Like, who possibly could have seen both of those movies making $1 billion?
Yeah. I did think it was funny that, like, my thought with Barbie was like, well, it could be a Margot Robbie play. And then, like, everybody else gets nominated and Margot's performance doesn't. I'll get over it eventually, maybe.
Yeah, you were a Margot voter from the very beginning, I know.
From the very beginning. I thought she was so good.
We'll get redemption for that. Well, there's one more clip that I'm going to include for our next year conversation, but we can end our flashback by looking back at what we predicted for Best Picture. Does anyone remember what they picked?
Unfortunately, yes.
I think I said Asteroid City.
You did. You described Wes Anderson as being overdue for the big win. And Richard, he won an Oscar. You might have won the closest.
Oh, God. How could I forget? His speech was amazing.
I think you win by default compared to the rest of us. Joe, you said you unfortunately remember what you picked.
I like elbowed Rebecca out of the way for The Color Purple, as I recall.
Oh, that's right. That's
true. Where Rebecca said The Color Purple, but there was some sort of audio error, and so we couldn't hear it. And so I like went instead, and I said The Color Purple, and boy, was I punished for my intransigence there.
Rebecca, do you remember what you picked instead?
Yeah, I went with, I think everything I talked about on that episode is a movie that didn't come out. I had picked Blitz, which is the Steve McQueen film with Saoirse Ronan that is coming out probably, I assume we're going to talk about in just a little bit.
Yeah. David, as we mentioned, you went with The Holdovers. So you got the one Best Picture nominee of anybody. Mm. So congratulations on that.
I'll take it.
And I went with Saltburn. On my logic that movies about families win Best Picture, which is a streak that's been broken. So now I have to regroup.
Oppenheimer's about chosen family.
It's true. I mean, the Los Alamos family really was going strong there.
Tell that to Emily Blunt in The Sheets.
I'm Chris Murphy.
I'm Richard Lawson.
And I'm Hilary Busis. We are from Vanity Fair's Still Watching podcast. Next up, we're watching the new HBO show, The Regime.
Madam Chancellor, let's keep the gloves on.
This is not a confrontation. We're just saying what's true.
Academy Award winner Kate Winslet is our chancellor as she leads a faux European autocracy in turmoil.
We'll be watching week by week as The Regime unravels.
And we'll be talking to the stars along the way.
New episodes of Still Watching will drop every Sunday after The Regime airs.
So yeah, let's kick off our look to the year ahead. And I think there's an obvious place to start, and there is a clip from last time to kick us off there.
My hope is that buoyed by the smash success of Mission Impossible, and also the fact that she was, I don't know, maybe in the conversation for Dune Part 1, that Rebecca Ferguson could somehow get a Sigourney Weaver in Aliens, the sequel kind of nomination.
Richard, would you like to double down?
I just think she's too small a part in the second movie. Yeah.
I think she's in more of the second movie, isn't she?
But it's not the same kind of, I don't know, the role kind of changes. She's sort of trancy and like, I don't know, like it doesn't quite feel as forceful as that character, Lady Jessica, is in the first Dune movie. But people love Dune too, so I think we can't count it out on any front.
I do feel like if there's an acting push to be made for Dune 2, I wonder if it's maybe Austin Butler.
Mm. Sure. Hmm.
He's, you know, really recent nominee, very sort of like flashy role. He's very intense in it. And I think quite good.
Spoiler alert. Sorry. Fast forward if you don't want to hear this. His arc is complete in theory.
Yes.
You know, so like that helps, I think.
Yeah, whereas you kind of get the sense that Zendaya in a third movie, which I guess we don't know when they will actually make it. It'll probably be a while, might have even more to do in a third film.
Yeah, well, especially given the way they end this movie, for sure. Yeah.
Villeneuve is running really low on spice, so he has to go get more and get his mind right to make the next movie. Now, he's making a different movie in between, I believe. Like, I think he's taking a break.
Smart move, I think.
I think our old friend Joanna Robinson was on a different podcast talking about whether or not Dune 2 would get treated like Lord of the Rings Two Towers. It's kind of like, okay, you made another one, but like, we'll wait for the third one to give you all your attention. And I'm not convinced that's how this is going to go. I kind of feel like they're not going to run the risk of, you know, the third one disappointing and go hard for Dune Part 2.
Well, everyone knew the third one, Lord of the Rings, had already been filmed.
Yes, exactly.
So, yeah, it was on the release schedule. And yeah. Like, it was months away by that point.
Also, as we're going to talk about, I don't know that we have as many heavy hitters like Dune 2 in this year's race. I mean, coming off of a year with Oppenheimer and Killers of the Flower Moon and Poor Things, etc., Barbie, these tech giants, like, I'm not sure the landscape is as massive, let's say, this season.
Right. I think that's right.
I don't know. A lot of my contenders are all in the tentpole realm.
All right, Kara, get us going.
What's
going to compete with Dune 2 for sheer scope at next year's Oscars?
You've got Gladiator 2. You've got Wicked. You've got, what was the other action-y one I was thinking about? I think The Fall Guy is going to be a very interesting conversation piece because of Ryan Gosling's continued, you know, he's doing the showman thing really well.
Yeah, I mean, The Fall Guy has incredible buzz from South By and from people who've seen it elsewhere, like you have, Kara. But the question of, like, summer blockbusters or Oscars, I think, is kind of open for that one, right?
Totally. That's what I'm really curious about, is some of these big action-y movies, if they're going to go the distance, as it were.
I think one thing that makes, like, these earlier predictions hard this year is that at Sundance this year, there wasn't, like, a Past Lives, and I don't think there was an Everything Everywhere at South By that I'm aware of.
You know? I believe that there was.
Oh, ooh. You do? Oh, okay, so correct. So I'm wrong. But at least
I think it's called Sing Sing, which has already premiered elsewhere, but it was huge over there.
Yeah, that was already at Toronto.
TIFF, yeah.
Correct.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, Katie, you were the herald of Sing Sing at Toronto.
I love
as far as
Sing
I remember.
Sing. Yeah. I mean, I don't know if we want to talk about it now or save till we get to actors, but yeah, I mean, I think Colman Domingo being back in the Best Actor lineup feels very likely to me.
Right. But maybe not a Best Picture. And I think that, like, A Real Pain from Sundance, which, like, that's a strong contender for Kieran Culkin's performance. But I don't think it's, like, big enough to be Best Picture or screenplay, maybe screenplay, but not director.
One thing you talked about out of Sundance, Richard, that I think is a question mark is Thelma, the June Squibb sort of action-y comedy. Only because comedic performances are not necessarily lauded, but with her being an elder states lady and people loving that. I didn't know if that might campaign that.
I mean, it's a small distributor. I think that it might be too much on the comedy side of things. There is, like, drama in it, but, like, compared to Nebraska, where June Squibb was the comic relief in that, in a way.
Gotcha.
This is not quite the same thing. But she also just booked the lead in, like, Scarlett Johansson's directorial debut. Yeah. I think June Squibb is not certainly out of any conversation. But I think Thelma might be a little too kind of mainstream. Maybe a Spirit Award nomination?
Sure. Yeah, gotcha.
The one other Sundance one that I had sort of thought of, and I didn't see this, but depending on how much stock we want to put in Berlin, Sebastian Stan did win the acting prize at Berlin for A Different Man, which had screened at Sundance. And that's an A24 movie. I think, again, we are probably once again going to be talking a lot about, like, how much A24 has on their plate and how much they're going to be able to dedicate to each of these. But that is one. When that news came across about Sebastian Stan winning in Berlin, I was like, oh, interesting. This could maybe be the stuff of a campaign.
I do think we're going to be talking about Sebastian Stan. Not just for A Different Man, but he's also playing Donald Trump.
Oh, right.
In the film The Apprentice, which is, I've heard, bound for Cannes.
Oh, wow. Is it sure. done?
Weren't
they filming that like a month
Jeremy
ago?
And Jeremy Strong. I mean, I don't know when exactly they filmed it, but the announcement was very recent. Sure. Yeah. And Jeremy Strong is playing Roy Cohn. So I don't even know what to say about that movie, except there's a lane for it if it actually pulls something interesting off in an election year where we all may want to go hide in our homes forever. Mm-hmm. So fun.
From Ali Abbasi, who directed
Holy Spider.
Thank you. And before that, the makeup nominee whose title is escaping me now.
Me too.
I could also see, like, in a way different from our obsession, Europeans are obsessed with Trump because he's more just kind of like a celebrity oddity to them. I mean, they know that right. he like destroys the world, you know, whatever. Like they know that he's like has serious power, but like, so I could kind of see like if that movie were at Cannes, like a jury, which mm-hmm. is not going to be all European, certainly like giving him Best Actor at Cannes. You know,
doesn't it remind you of Joker at Venice a little bit?
Oh, boy.
Yeah, exactly. Like, let's look at this like American, you know, strangeness and whatever. Yeah. And, you know, Ali Abbasi directed another actor to a best actress prize at Cannes with Holy Spider. So mm-hmm. could be.
David, you brought up Joker. Does that mean you want to talk about Joker Folie à Deux? I'm going to have to learn how to pronounce that.
I'm looking forward to the Lady Gaga campaign. Mm-hmm. As Rebecca alluded to, A Star is Born, it's always very entertaining. Mm-hmm. I think it probably cost her a Best Actress nomination for House of Gucci because it went a little over the line for some people. But it's going to be a moment. I don't like Joker, just to be like totally transparent. So I'm not like personally expecting to like this movie.
Well, David, no one likes Joker. He's the clown prince of crime. He's dangerous.
I like Jack Nicholson's Joker.
What about Zazie Beetz? I think she took a liking
to him. She did like Joker. Well, at least in his fantasies, yeah.
Yeah, fair enough. But, you know, what can we say about it? It's going to get a full rollout, and those who loved the first one, I suspect, will be very excited for the second one.
One of the interesting sort of trends of this year, and this sort of goes a little bit to what Kara was saying also, is the fact that there's a handful of sequels or prequels, I guess, to movies that were Best Picture nominees or winners that feel like just how singular were those things. Joker is one of them. Mm-hmm. Furiosa following up Mad Max is one of them. I think Gladiator 2 is also another one where it's like, how much can we sort of like pencil in a sequel to movies that felt like they were a little bit of a lightning in a bottle kind of a thing. Maybe a little bit less so with Gladiator, and that there's that like connection to Ben-Hur and Oscar history a little bit. But like Mad Max and Joker particularly feel like they were like real of the moment, like once in a lifetime kind of Oscar stories. And I wonder if it's going to be harder to make that happen again with movies that, unless these movies really do like improve upon the original, and like particularly with Furiosa following up Fury Road, I'm skeptical. So
yeah, I think you're so right. That is the question, I think, because, you know, obviously we don't know if they're any good, but yeah, the singularness of those nominees and winners. I agree.
It's funny that, like, obviously Mad Max is tied to IP, Joker tightly tied to IP, but, like, they were singular even in their franchises, if you even want to loosely call them part of a franchise. Mm-hmm. But, like, it's funny. And then they got, you know, they did win Oscars or, you know, whatever. And now, like, Hollywood's like, okay, we know you don't like franchise films and you kind of want more things, but here, is this a happy medium? Could we do one? Can we do one sequel, please, for each one? Like,
right.
Could we please do Gladiator 2?
Like, it's like it's methadone. They're, like, weaning themselves off of franchises, and it's just like, okay, well, maybe just a little bit. We'll give you a little franchise.
It's like they're hiding, you know, vegetables and food. No. It's an awards movie. We swear. Right. But it's actually a franchise.
Right. We haven't even gotten that. Also, like in animation, right? We have Moana 2 and Inside Out 2, which are both, those were both, you know, highly lauded. It's going to be just an interesting time.
I don't know what to do with Moana 2. I've seen that movie more than maybe any other movie in my entire life, and I don't want it. And it was supposed to be like a Disney Plus series that they turned into a movie?
Correct.
Yeah.
So wait, there's the Moana 2, which is animated, and then there's a live-action Moana also happening.
In theory. Right? I don't understand why they would do both, but I guess they haven't said they're canceling either of them.
May I introduce you to the concept of money?
It must cost so much to make a live-action Moana on, like, the ocean. Like, don't we all know that that costs a fortune?
Well, no, because the first one's all rotoscope, so they just take the animation off and they have the raw footage.
It is what Wayne Johnson looks like.
Annette Bening's going to loan them for swimming.
That's true. That's true.
Can I throw out a not quite a sequel, but sort of a sequel to a Oscar winning movie? And this is two movies, which is Horizons Part 1 and 2. I mean, they're not a sequel to Dances with Wolves, but that certainly is the vein in which I think we're supposed to welcome these. Yellowstone has very famously not really gotten any traction with the Emmys at all, despite being a massive hit. I think it's probably the most likely that these movies would do the same thing. Like, if they are hits, they will not be the kind of thing that the Oscars will pay attention to. But there's not a lot of like big, you know, swaggering filmmakers movies out there this year. So I don't feel like we should underestimate it.
Never before have a pair of movies that I am personally so uninterested in have I so rooted for to be Oscar successes. Like, I feel like it's just a much more interesting landscape if like Kevin Costner's back is a storyline. And yeah. I would very much welcome that.
If Horizons wins more Oscars than Flower Moon, which is to say any, that would be bad for the discourse, let's say. I know that judging from the trailer, the movie is not, it is including Native American characters and whatnot, but I don't think it's from that perspective in any way.
Right.
You know, that said, if it's just a big sweeping kind of verging on cornball Western, like, or two of them, like I'm ready to be entertained, but I don't really necessarily have any expectations for them to be awards movies, but maybe I'm totally wrong.
Is he going to like only campaign for part two? Like, how is that going?
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Because you can't be nominated for both movies.
Right.
Yeah. Those movies being released like 6 weeks apart is still one of the craziest things that's going to happen this summer.
The
TVification
of movies continues.
Yeah, pretty much. You know, while I'm looking at the summer calendar, do you know what has the Barbie Oppenheimer release date this year? Is Twisters.
Yeah, oh, man.
Joe, and I think you and Glenn. I are both already all in on Twisters based on the Super Bowl commercial.
I was in on Twisters even before that because they have managed to assemble a cast of uniformly the hottest of hotties. And also Lee Isaac Chung, who I was such a big fan of Minari. And this is such a weird follow-up. And yet I'm like, you know what? Like, high-low culture, man. Like, I'm into it. And now there are two Twisters, maybe at once. Like,
twins, twins. Yeah. They yell that in the trailer.
They do.
We know from Minari that Lee Isaac Chung is really good at filming flat territory in the middle of the country.
Yep.
That's true.
Yep, that's so all you need.
That's kind of all you need. But, you know, I hope that Twisters is good. I have colleagues who, not at VF, but who are like, oh, that movie's gonna tank, no one really cares, no one really remembers the original.
What?
And like, that might be true of Gen Z, but like, I don't know, I think that the Glenn Powell brings them in, and then us more nostalgic older people would go anyway because it's a Twister sequel. But yeah, I don't know. I hope that Lee Isaac Chung made a lot of money. And now for his next film he can go back to more sort of, you know, awardsy stuff.
Yeah. I've seen the original Twister more than a lot of films in life.
Me too.
I love it.
It's such a great film.
Last time I saw it, it was on AMC, which stands for American Movie Classics.
That sure does.
So that says it all as far as I'm concerned.
If I had been an Oscar voter that year, I would have been tempted to put Jamie Gertz in supporting actress for this.
Oh, good.
She's so good. She's so good in it.
Jamie, as you should.
Yeah.
She's so New York and out of her element, Richard. I mean, my God.
Do we want to let ourselves entertain the hope of Glenn Powell Oscar buzz with this and Hitman both coming this year? Or does he need to do something that is more serious and less charming before they'll go for him?
I am curious to see how Hitman, like, you know, extends beyond a summer premiere. It's such a fun movie. It's such a great summer movie. It's also a Netflix movie.
Yep.
And that can be a real challenge. I don't know of any Netflix movies released that early that had any real awards traction. But this is a different kind of acquisition for them, and I would hope a different kind of rollout. And he is, like, impossibly charming in this movie, and I would argue deserves a campaign. So we can hope.
Yeah, let's do it. Action movie Oscar pushes. I'm happy for all of them.
Kara's coming back for that episode, that's for sure.
I need Netflix to do well by that movie. I need Netflix to do well by another TIFF movie that I really loved, which is His Three Daughters.
Yes.
That I think is absolutely, it was one of the best things, if not the best thing I saw in Toronto. And I don't know how it doesn't end up making my top 10 this year once it gets released, because it's that good. And I very much worry about the, you know, the Netflix hole effect, where if you're not one of the handful of movies that they've chosen to prioritize, then you really just do sort of disappear. And I would hate for that to happen to that movie.
I will say, based on my initial impressions of how they feel about that movie, it will be one of those top priorities.
Good, because that's three tremendous acting performances. Natasha Lyonne, Carrie Coon, Elizabeth Olsen. My God.
And I think there's a very clear lane to take Natasha Lyonne particularly very far for kind of a revelatory performance.
And if Netflix can be the ones who get Natasha Lyonne her Oscar nomination, that's like a feather in their cap.
It's a full circle from Orange is the New Black, too.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and Russian Doll.
Yeah.
As Joe can attest, because I had lunch with him directly after I saw that movie, I could like barely talk.
You still had tears in your eyes when you showed up for lunch.
I cried the whole walk to the restaurant. Like,
yeah.
But it's not like a miserable sit. It's very cathartic cry.
Yeah.
But it really snuck up on me because I didn't like Azazel Jacobs' previous film. This one is really strong. And I think you're right, David, that like the Lyonne campaign, much like Kieran Culkin in A Real Pain, no-brainers. Absolute no-brainers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
I mean, Netflix is kind of an open question for this coming season, right? Because I think, you know, they've famously had some executive shifts. It seems like they might be focusing more on some broader appeals than award season stuff. Obviously, they haven't given up on that stuff at all. But you look like further down into the calendar and there's just not really a Maestro or a Power of the Dog that I can see coming up.
They have a couple of movies that I think are big swings that could just be absolutely not awards movies at all, and yet I'm still incredibly interested in them. One of them is the Tyler Perry movie, 6888, which is a sort of more Tony option for him. Women working in the war effort, I believe is what the log line is telling me. Kerry Washington is in it. That's intriguing to me. The one I'm actively excited for is Lee Daniels' The Deliverance, which is, among other things, his reunion with Monique, which is loudly anticipated. But it's also like Lee Daniels and Monique and Glenn Close and Anjanou Alice Taylor doing a horror movie. Like, Lee Daniels should have been making horror movies this whole time.
I was just going to say, Lee Daniels in a horror movie. Yes, exactly.
Yeah, 100%.
You also potentially have for Netflix lurking another actor long overdue for Oscar attention. I mean, he has one nomination is Samuel L. Jackson.
And he
has The Piano Lesson, which he did on Broadway. It's an August Wilson play. I don't remember what kind of reviews that production got, but like
he got
really
a Tony
matter?
Nomination though, right? I believe
he thought he was going to win.
Based on his reaction when he did.
Oh.
That's right.
Right.
That's right.
Looking that clip up.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think someone from the Tom Stoppard play won instead. Brandon Uranowitz, I think it was. But like, you know, if Netflix, which, you know, had good success with Ma Rainey, which is also August Wilson, Viola Davis didn't win the Oscar, but she won the SAG. You know, they know how to run those movies, I think. And like a narrative about Samuel Jackson remember last year when Robert Downey Jr. won an Oscar after doing so much service to Marvel? Well, here's your next guy with a troubled history and a Marvel career, and he's overdue and used to be a more serious actor and then kind of stop. Like, it's almost the same narrative, except I would argue that I think Jackson is much more beloved in a way, like universally. So
The female lead in that is Danielle Deadwyler. Similar to how we were talking about Andrew Scott, I think out of the Till miss, she did kind of reach that echelon where the nomination is a matter of when, not if. And Netflix knows how to get acting nominations. Colman Domingo, Annette Bening, Ana de Armas, these names over the last few years that were hardly assured, but the campaigns got them there. One other Netflix movie I would mention that I don't think is on many's radar, and I don't even know if they're positioning it this way, is Pedro Páramo. It is a Spanish language adaptation being directed by Rodrigo Prieto, who is the DP of Killers of the Flower Moon and Barbie this past year. Netflix has, I think, leaned into understanding that international contenders are a real point of focus for the Academy now and therefore for them. You know, All Quiet on the Western Front was a huge surprise for them. Society on the Snow was both a big commercial hit and got them multiple nominations. So I do think Pedro Páramo, it's just what I'm looking at. I have no idea if they have plans for it, but obviously there's a lot of pedigree behind it and it could fill that niche.
Speaking of pedigree, we kind of got off of A24, but I wanted to go back to it and back to Blitz, Rebecca, which you were really high on last year. It still hasn't shown up. I have to assume it'll be here this year at some point. Are you still feeling as optimistic about it?
I am. I remember I was in Cannes and I interviewed Steve McQueen about his four-hour documentary film. And I was like, so when is Blitz coming out? Because it was my pick. And I was like, I really want to make sure this movie. And he was like, not this year. But I think, you know, with Saoirse Ronan and Harris Dickinson and the fact that it's sort of this big World War II film, I feel optimistic that, you know, he'll be back in the conversation if they do release it this year, which I think they will.
Yeah, we were just talking about Harris Dickinson really popping off of Iron Claw. So that does feel like an ideal. You had your moment, now come back.
It does feel like there's a moment approaching for Harris Dickinson, especially after Triangle of Sadness as well. That was the Best Picture nominee and all that.
And Saoirse, you know, she has not had an Oscar moment in a few years. She's had a few misses with some of the films she's had lately. She has both this and The Outrun, which was a big hit for her at Sundance. It hasn't been acquired, I believe. And I would imagine that is partly because there's this Goliath of a likely contender looming this year.
Right. And why spend the money to campaign for her for The Outrun when they can never, they can't outgun Blitz, I guess, is the thinking.
Outrun can't outgun, say it perfectly.
So Blitz is, by most conventional thinking, not going to play Cannes.
That's what I've heard.
That feels like more of a Venice-y thing, maybe. Mm. But I think if you look at what's been rumored to be at Cannes, there are some interesting things cropping up. Ben Whishaw has a starring role in, I believe, the first English language film from Kirill Serebrennikov, who is like a pretty well-regarded Russian filmmaker, and it's a biopic. And I feel like Ben Whishaw has been sort of on that nomination cusp for a while. He was like, people thought he might get nominated for
Women Talking.
Passages? Women Talking. Thank you. Yeah. I almost said Certain Women. you know, so he's in there. Another sort of more outlier that I think is interesting. There's a rumor that this musical from Jacques Audiard, who did like Rust and Bone, among other things, starring Zoe Saldana, is going to be at Cannes. None of this is confirmed, but like, wouldn't it be really interesting to see Zoe Saldana have an Oscar campaign? She also is like a huge franchise person who has done some smaller, you know, more serious things, one of which was very controversial. So I don't know. Those could be two fun narratives that could potentially emerge from Cannes.
Speaking of Cannes, I'm curious, have we heard that Yorgos's movie is going to go there? It's a June release.
I think it's dated for June, right?
So it would make sense.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think obviously we have to keep an eye on it. It's called Kinds of Kindness now, and it has an incredible cast, including Emma Stone. I don't know. Like, what are the odds of back-to-back nominations or wins here? But, you know, I think I'm really, really curious to see it.
It's also Yorgos sort of going back to lobster mode a little bit, in that the last two movies of his were written by Tony McNamara, which the Favorite and Poor Things. And this is, I'm going to absolutely butcher his co-writer's name, but Aftsmis Philippou, who is co-screen wrote The Lobster and Killing of a Sacred Deer, all the way back to, I believe, Dogtooth. So it'll be interesting to see if this movie is tonally still what Oscar voters respond to after they have basically, well, they nominated Dogtooth for and Lobster for screenplay. I'm just going to like come up with thoughts as I think of them, as I talk about Kinds of Kindness. Do you know what I'm talking about, though? You just like, you wonder whether the shift in tone will be noticeable.
The Academy does like that fancy fake old-timey talkie.
Yes, they do.
Yeah.
It gets them through a lot of weirdness.
Yeah,
they're like, it's period. It's great.
Yeah, exactly.
The success of Poor Things, I just think, does that give them all, Yorgos and company, you know, his co-stars, Emma too, like license to get even wackier and weirder with their future projects?
I do think we should talk about Cannes a lot because it fielded three of the 10 nominees this past year. So, you know, what is going to be The Anatomy of a Fall, for instance? We don't know. I'm looking at Emmanuel, which is from Audrey Diwan. Her film Happening won the Golden Lion. France should have selected it That year they went with Titan instead, but it was a much more typical contender that I think could have done really well for them. This is a movie with Naomi Watts, Naomi Merlant, and Neon Artie's handling it. And Neon, we know, Neon plus Can Neon tends plus to go Can. Very well.
Yep.
But if we're looking for a kind of breakout that we're not, that, you know, a sleeper, that is one that caught my eye.
Yeah, I think in terms of, you got me sort of thinking about Neon also, and they have a couple that I have my eye on this year, one of which, Richard, you mentioned sort of a musical. This is another post or end of the world musical starring Tilda Swinton and Michael Shannon. It's called The End, directed by Joshua Oppenheimer, who is a 2-time Oscar nominee for documentary. He directed The Act of Killing and The Look of Silence. And this seems just on the edge of super weird. And that's sort of where I like my Tilda Swinton, Michael Shannon movies. So I'm into that. There is also a movie called The Actor that Neon is attached to with director Duke Johnson, where Andre Holland plays a New York actor who is beaten and left for dead in 1950s Ohio and loses his memory. And I love the idea of an acting showcase for Andre Holland, who has sort of long been waiting to break out. So I'm into both of these things.
We've mentioned a few biopics already. I think that the biopic thing has maybe slowed a little bit at the Oscars, but can never be counted out.
A biopic just won Best Picture.
No, I know, but that feels sort of different. I mean, like the biopic where it's like all about this one central performance, you know, transformation. And
like
by that,
Rustin.
I mean,
like the Rustin.
A Rustin kind of thing. Do you guys remember that actor Angelina Jolie?
Oh, yeah.
I feel like she hasn't done a lot of acting in recent years, but she has a Pablo Larraín movie. He has good luck with getting, you know, actresses nominated about Maria Callas, the famous opera singer. And I don't know, that just feels like Angelina Jolie in a Woodside motorboat heading to the premiere at Venice.
Yeah.
And then it's off to the races. You know, that would be kind of exciting because it's been, what, since Changeling, right, that Angelina Jolie has been in that conversation.
Yeah. I would love that. Yeah.
And then on the more, I don't know how funny this movie is going to be versus like serious, but like the SNL movie about the opening, the first, episode, I guess.
That's crazy.
SNL.
It's coming out this year because they just started filming, right?
Do we know for sure? Like, I mean, Jason Reitman loves a TIFF premiere. So like if he can make it, he would do it. But maybe would next year be more likely?
I mean, movies shoot for like 4 weeks nowadays. Like, I don't know.
Right.
Like it could be done with editing by the summer. And that means that it could be, you know, I mean, what if they premiered at the New York Film Festival for opening night? And so it's a big SNL opening night of the New York Film Festival party, you know?
The cast is also incredibly stacked with really exciting, interesting young talent. Gabriel LaBelle from The Fablemans, Cooper Hoffman from Licorice Pizza, Rachel Sennett, Corey Michael Smith, who I was so high on in May, December. Very, very, very interesting. Gabriel LaBelle as Lorne Michaels might be like my most anticipated performance of this year, just to see what that ends up being. I so loved him in The Fablemans. So we'll see.
I put question marks around two other titles that I don't know. I think have either been filmed or are filming, but we don't know if they'll be out this year. The PTA movie that has Leonardo DiCaprio and a whole bunch of other people in it. And
I think
then,
it's dated for next summer.
Yes, that's what I heard.
All right,
as well.
So I'll put that on the list. How about Megalopolis?
How about Megalopolis?
Well, is it coming didn't out Coppola this year? Say, like, it's going to come out this spring, I swear, like, it's done. And so then people started saying, okay, so it's going to be at Cannes. And, you know, Apocalypse Now premiered at Cannes, and so there's a nice symmetry to that. And I don't know. I mean, I feel like he's been talking about this movie for a long time.
I was
going to
say, for as long as this movie's been in development, I feel like we'll get it. We'll know we're getting it when we're seated in front of it, you know, almost like it's. But yeah, I'm so excited for Megalopolis. My God, like, talk about an Oscar narrative. If Francis Ford Coppola, like, sells his vineyard and self-finances this movie with, you know, this amazing cast, and it's sci-fi and it's, you know, his long-awaited passion project, and God, just no end of narratives for that one.
There's a new Mike Leigh movie which I'm personally very excited about. Marion Jean-Baptiste reuniting with him. I don't know a ton about it. It's being handled by Bleecker Street, who haven't had much Oscar success since COVID. But this is a movie that could definitely get them back on the board. And I think if Mike Leigh makes a great movie, it will be taken seriously. And the other one I think we should talk about is Conclave, the follow-up from Edward Berger, who directed All Quiet on the Western Front, multi-Oscar winner. This is a Focus Features movie with Ralph Fiennes, I believe, in the lead. Focus dated it for November just recently, which to me is a real sign of confidence in having a major awards player. They obviously just had an Oscar-winning movie in The Holdovers, so... that's one that feels like a very likely end of year player to me.
And Ralph Fiennes is someone who got like two nominations in the 90s, right?
And then nothing.
Maintained his movie stardom, thanks largely to Harry Potter for you know, decades afterward. But like another person who's ready to get back in that side of the conversation.
Yes. And overlooked really wrongly a number of times lately. Yes. So he's due.
David, can I read you the IMDb plot description of Hard Truths, the Mike Leigh movie, which is my favorite thing that I've read in quite a while? It says, ongoing exploration of the contemporary world with a tragic comic study of human strengths and weaknesses.
Yep. Like, yep. Oh, boy.
It's a Mike Leigh movie.
That sounds like a Mike Leigh movie to me.
So. Maybe Leslie Manville's Another Year character will make a cameo.
God, if only.
Dream. If I can name check another big name director, Clint Eastwood's coming back.
Hell yeah.
In a movie. Tony Collette, speaking of people who are overdue, and also Nicholas Holt, who I'm guessing is the titular juror number two.
I think
they're
so,
the leads.
Yes.
It's the About a Boy reunion we've all been clamoring for.
Yes.
Really?
Especially Rebecca.
I mean, I think as, you know, someone who loves the 90s legal thrillers, like we all really loved The Burial last year, for this to come back and be awards year, I would be delighted.
There's also the potential that this is a final film narrative, if they choose to market it that way. I think that there has been some reporting about that being a possibility. They may just be testing the waters on how much resonance that will have, / how likely it is.
Don't you assume he'll be like Miyazaki and Scorsese? He'd be like, nope, I'm not leaving. Can't make me.
All you have to do is pretend for 4 months and then you're good.
Well, speaking of that, and I don't know if this movie is definitely coming out this year. This might be a little bit too early, but James L. Brooks is making another movie, which... Mm-hmm. So thrilling to me. It's called Ella McKay, or at least right now it's called Ella McKay. James L. Brooks's movies tend to go through title changes up until...
And land on great titles like How Do You Know?
Exactly. But that one, Emma Mackey, Jack Loudon, I guess, is attached to that. Jamie Lee Curtis. A James L. Brooks dramedy, like, okay. It's about a young female politician who gets appointed governor of a state. Listen, at this point, I'm in for anything. I know James L. Brooks' last movie, the aforementioned How Do You Know, was not very good, but I would like James L. Brooks to put a better capper on his directorial career. So.
And I think that there were enough similarities to his cadence in American Fiction, which did very well at the Oscars, that it had me at least being like, ooh, I kind of like would like to see a James L. Brooks movie again.
Yeah.
And then here comes this
here
one.
We
So we'll see.
Well, we were talking earlier about Jeremy Allen White having kind of a break into movies with Iron Claw, and Iota Berry is also in the cast for this. And I mean, she is just absolutely everywhere, kind of unstoppable. So that's something you can really imagine if that movie hits, that she would be a likely one to promote from that.
Yeah.
I wanted to bring up two Amazon MGM movies that I don't know if they're coming out, but I do feel like after what we, you know, Amazon MGM had Air and Saltburn, and yes, it did, neither really performed as they probably had hoped, but I do think they are really pushing into the award space and want these nominations and wins. So, I was looking at Holland, Michigan, which stars Nicole Kidman.
Yeah.
And Gael Garcia Bernal, which I'm really curious about, but it's pretty, neither of these have release dates, or The Nickel Boys, which has our favorite Anjanou Ellis in it. And I think we all are dying for her to sort of get more recognition in this space. And if either of those, and that's based on a Colson Whitehead book. So I think if either of those come out this year, they could both have really strong chances in the race. And I think Amazon would really push for strong campaigns.
basically what we're saying is, like, everyone get working, get these films done so we can have, like, the craziest Toronto ever.
Yes! Yes! God, we need it.
We do.
Nickel Boys, though, is directed by Ramel Ross, who directed a documentary called Hale County This Morning, This Evening, which was a thing a few years ago, and I remember thinking was quite good. So that's a point in Nickel Boys' favor.
It shot a while ago. We had Anjanou Ellis-Taylor on Little Gold Men last summer, and she talked about the filming of it, and she seemed pretty excited about it. So, should be ready. Nice.
I'm excited for some Anne Hathaway action this year, I have to say.
Yeah.
She's in a new movie directed by David Lowery called Mother Mary, where she stars opposite Michaela Cole, where... says it follows the relationship between a fictional musician and a famous fashion designer. I believe Hathaway is the musician and Michaela Cole is the fashion designer, although I've been wrong on plot stuff before on our Year Ahead episodes, so grain of salt. But that, to me, I love David Lowery as a filmmaker. I think he's a tremendously underrated director. And I think if this could be a breakthrough Oscar movie for him, and, you know, Anne Hathaway was so good last year in Eileen on this sort of like very kind of like low key, you know, not a lot of people saw that movie, but if you did, you really came away with sort of affected by her performance. And I think a two-hander with her and Michaela Cole would be kind of rad.
She's also got that Jessica Chastain two-hander.
Oh my God, yeah. Yes. Which is Yassified, a map of the world, as I described it on my podcast.
Which a reference, Joe, that very few people will get to a Julianne Moore Sigourney Weaver film from many years ago.
If you know, is all I'm saying.
Yeah. So, it's great for Cinematrix.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, yeah. Plug Joe's side project. I want to bring up two movies that I think if everything goes really, really well, they'll be awardsy and otherwise won't. But how are we feeling about both Wicked Part 1 and Mufasa arriving later this year from filmmakers we like on very big platforms? And I'm not really sure what to make of either.
I mean, they'll campaign Wicked.
Who's going to bet on a late entry musical at this point? We've been burned so many times.
I was going to say, we've been burned so many times. I can't say that that trailer gave me a ton of good feeling about it. So
certainly not for Oscars at minimum. Right. It just didn't seem to be scratching that itch at all.
Yeah.
If Ariana Grande gets nominated for Wicked, I don't think I'm ever talking to a gay person ever again, because that would just be like,
nope. I'll share that pact with you, Richard.
It would be too much. I'm not saying I'm rooting against it. I just mean like, it just, that movie, it doesn't feel like Wicked is being like Oscar positioned. It's more like gigantic blockbuster positioned, but maybe, but it also suffers from the Part 1 of it all, I think.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, right. I think so too. The thing with The Color Purple was that it was, It did feel like the commercial and awards prospects of the movie were kind of entwined. And I don't know that that's as true for Wicked.
Well, and The Color Purple also had the awards pedigree, the Oscar pedigree with the Spielberg movie, too. So that was almost inevitable. Whereas, like, Wicked doesn't have that kind of... actually, I say that. Yeah, there's a little movie called The Wizard of Oz, but it's not the same thing.
It's quite different.
But I do wonder, like, with the... Yeah, Wicked obviously is part of, like, known IP, whatever. But, like, there have been some gambles recently where people assume that Broadway audiences are reflective of national audiences, which is just not the case. And sadly, wasn't the case for In the Heights. Not as sadly, it was not the case for Dear Evan Hansen. one of which got great reviews, one of which didn't. And they both sort of had similar, trajectories at the box office.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't know. Like, Wicked, obviously, it's been around for 20 plus years. It's at least one of the songs is very like known, at least, you know, by a lot of people. But I don't know. I have this kind of like little lingering like doubt in my head that Wicked being a huge Broadway hit that just toured nationally, all that, does that translate? Are there enough people in the U.S., let's say specifically, who are that eager to see that particular musical on film?
I feel like it'll be a good yardstick for that phenomenon, Richard, in terms of like what the reach of, you know, what exactly is the reach of a Broadway show that has been playing for however many years. God, quite a while, I would imagine.
22,
now.
I think.
20-something years, and has been touring 21. All that time, and is also like a, you know, crossover touchstone for a lot of people who were, you know, young and have, you know, grown into adulthood and stuff like that. It'll be an interesting yardstick in an environment where it was pulling teeth to get people to see West Side Story.
Yeah.
And I know that was still in, like, you know, 2021, we were still sort of emerging and going back into theaters and stuff like that. But I have been burned on musicals so many times. I can't do it again in terms of predicting success.
West Side Story did win an Oscar, though. So.
It did. What you guys are saying is you don't want to talk about Mufasa.
I want Barry Jenkins to be able to make movies. And that's my bottom line with Mufasa.
Let's hope for a good opening weekend.
Plus, Aaron Pierre is in that. Isn't he the lead? He was in my favorite movie at Toronto like 2 years ago called Brother. He's an incredible.
Sarah Pauly loved that movie.
That movie is very good. It did not get enough attention. But he's a phenomenal talent, I think. So that'll be interesting.
He's playing Malcolm X in the Genius series right now, which I don't think is very good, but he's kind of amazing in it.
Oh, he's so great. Great.
I have not seen that. Photorealistic computer gender, what do we call these movies?
Yeah, what don't. Is it?
The Academy's not.
Live action remakes, but right. Live action in quotes.
I don't think that the Barry Jenkins directing credit is going to change those movies' awards votes too much.
Yeah.
All right, as we get toward wrapping this up, let's just do a lightning round quick. Everyone name one more title that you want to have on the record that you mentioned or just intrigued by. Rebecca, let's start with you.
Well, I'm going to go with an A24 movie that I will pay millions of dollars to see because it stars Florence Pugh and Andrew Garfield. And it's called We Live in a Time, and it's directed by John Crowley, who directed Brooklyn. I'm wondering if it's a small romantic movie that is not an Oscar contender, but I don't care. I'm going to see this movie, and I'm very excited for it. So I'll just put it on the record.
Yeah. Joe.
Another A24 movie that I had my eye on, Andrea Arnold, who directed American Honey. Among other movies, has a movie called Bird coming out that co-stars Barry Keoghan and Franz Rogowski. And they're keeping the plot details tightly under wraps, which, you know, I'm an easy sell for intrigue like that. So couldn't have a pair of buzzier actors after this year, especially. And Andrea Arnold, who also did Fish Tank, which I remember being very, very sort of into it at a point where like it was very small. It was a very small movie, but Michael Fassbender movie there. But yeah, I'm very into whatever Andrea Arnold's got cooking with these two guys.
How exciting would it be for Andrea Arnold to be in the awards conversation?
Mm-hmm. Right? Amazing.
I can jump off of that with another director I think we're all avowed fans of here. We need to say Night Bitch, just because it's fun to say, and also Marielle Heller, who has made excellent movies, and Amy Adams. Our eternal process of rooting for Amy Adams to get what she deserves from the Oscars after it's been a long while. You know, for a long time, she got nominated constantly. It's been some time, so possibly this adaptation of a pretty popular novel that I haven't read, but hopefully we'll have read by the time it comes out, might get her there.
And that's Searchlight, right? I mean, they
know how to run that kind of campaign. Yeah, I think for a while we worried it might go to Hulu, but I think that we have blessedly moved past that time in our lives. Dave, you want to go?
I was going to do Bird, so I have to. I will go. Kind of a two-parter with Luca Guadagnino.
Yeah.
Challengers. I'm not sure that that's going to be an Oscar movie. It's coming out in the spring, but he also has a film called Queer that doesn't have distribution yet with Daniel Craig. And Guadagnino has been a little bit outside of the award space, a little bit too I could just say gory side, honestly, with a few of his recent movies. Not that Challengers will be gory. But this one, I'm curious to see if it can pop and find a good home.
Kara, you want to make one last one you want to mention?
Yes, I'm going to, out of the box, another A24 movie. I don't even know if it's dated. It's dated for 2024. I just don't know when it's going to come out. It's called Tuesday. It's a debut feature from a director, Dana P. Pusich. Hopefully I'm pronouncing that right. It's a really weird sort of fantasy film, a lot about grief. But Julie Louis-Dreyfus, it's the most different and unique performance I've ever seen her give. And I think it's that is the reason to see it, is she's really different and really great to watch in that.
Richard, you get to mention one more before we make our best picture predictions.
Probably a long shot, but he had The Childhood of a Leader and then Vox Lux. And I think interest in Brady Corbett as a director sort of waned a little bit post Vox Lux. But like maybe the sophomore feature was the stumbling block, as it often is. And his third film, The Brutalist, which has Adrian Brody, Felicity Jones, Guy Pearce, Joe Alwyn, and Raffi Cassidy, who's also in Vox Lux. It's on Joe's sheet as post-production from Focus. So if that gets a big festival thing, maybe that's like the weird, vaguely Euro art house thing that makes its way all the way.
Yeah. Okay, now we can close out with the hard part, which is making our year ahead Best Picture winner predictions. I do think The Strike weirdness is hitting us here in some way. Mm-hmm. There's just like there's just not the depth of the bench of things that you see coming. And, you know, that's how you get winners like Coda and Everything Everywhere All at Once. It always finds a way of working itself out. But I think it makes this part really hard because I just am not sure that we see any kind of obvious path for a Best Picture winner, not just having real Oscar success. Does anyone feel more confident than I am?
I want to go before Joe. That's all I'm saying.
Ha-ha. Yes, yes. Please do.
Justice.
Not that either of us was successful. I'll go first because I feel like I have Blitz on record from last year in case it wins, so I'm not going to pick it again. But my theory is that you don't have to be a fall release. You know, we look at Oppenheimer, Everything Everywhere, Coda. So I'm going to go with a summer release, and I'm going to go with Furiosa because it's going to be big. It's Anya Taylor-Joy, who I feel like everyone loves. And George Miller has only won for Happy Feet in animation. So I feel like he's sort of due for something. And Mad Max Fury Road got 10 nominations, 6 wins. Obviously, those were all in craft. But I feel like maybe if this film is great, there's a strong narrative there for him.
I love that pick. Joe, do you want to try to follow up and step on Rebecca's toes anyway?
I have absolutely no idea what's going to happen. Like this, this has been the first year in a very long time where I'm looking at the whole landscape and I'm like, your guess is as good as mine. So part of me wants to like take Blitz and just be like, well, Rebecca and I were in the handcuffed to each other throughout eternity with this, and this is fine. Part of me also wants to, I know we threw out all the movies we threw out, but part of me wants to just say Robert Eggers' Nosferatu is opening on Christmas Day, and that's that's the phenomenon. I'm gonna say The Piano Lesson. I don't know, for lack of a better, you know, anything, The Piano Lesson.
I like that one. Mm-hmm. Okay, I think I just came up with one, so I'm just going to go with it in case someone else steals it. I say, why not Conclave? Edward Berger, proven Oscar track record. Ralph Fiennes, as we said, we're all going to be rooting for. Focus has faith in it, as David pointed out. You know, again, your guess is as good as mine, so I'm just going to put my stamp on that one. And if it wins 4 Oscars like All Quiet, I'll be proud.
There you go.
Okay, Kara, you take your turn.
I sort of want to take Blitz just because neither of the people that really championed it wanted to. But I got to stick with my action movie hope. I'm going to say Gladiator 2. I wanted to say Fall Guy.
I love that.
I wanted to say The Fall Guy because I really do think that is going to have a really wild, funny campaign. But I'm going to say Gladiator 2 and just hope that it's amazing and somehow pulls out a sequel bit of excellence.
I mean, we've said so many years on this that Ridley Scott still doesn't have an Oscar. He's still waiting. Yes. Like, you know, time is running out. Let's do it.
Yeah.
I say this as someone who enjoyed Napoleon, but I feel like he's moving in the wrong direction along those lines. But we'll see. We'll see.
Yeah.
All right, David or Richard.
I can go.
Okay.
So it gets done just under the wire, has a huge Cannes premiere, and then however many months later, Adam Driver wins an Oscar finally, Aubrey Plaza gets her first, and Megalopolis wins Best Picture.
I love it.
I mean, that's what we're all hoping for, right? That would be the most unbelievable Oscars here.
I mean, we do see a wide open field here. So Coppola, come on in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, David, you get to make the last pick.
I'm going in the opposite direction. this year's reminding me a bit of the Coda year, just because it is weird. It feels like there's a lot of, you know, old masters returning who might not have the goods to deliver something in, on that scale of Oppenheimer. I'm going to pick Sing Sing.
Ooh,
I'm just imagining
it's
that
not a
crew.
Bad idea. Yeah.
I'm imagining that crew on the trail starting in the summer, doing a long-term campaign, charming the hell out of everybody. Coleman Domingo's incredible in it. You cannot have a better salesperson for the movie. And A24 knows how to do this. So I guess that's playing it safe, which tells you how far we've come in the last few years with the Oscars. But I think it's a real contender. And I think we could see a smaller movie pull it out this year.
That's a great pick.
Okay, that does it for our massive 2025 Oscar predictions episode. Joe is going to be writing a story for VF.com to go along with this to kind of explain all these choices that we made. So you can find that and so much more at VanityFair.com. Find us on social media at VF Awards Insider. And me, I am at Katie Rich and Richard.
Rylos.
And David.
David Canfield 97.
And Rebecca, although I hope you're not on social media for a little bit longer until you go back to work.
Becca M. Ford.
And Kara.
Kara J. Warner.
And Joe, you can promote social media and anything else.
Sure. If you want to find me on social media, my handle is at Joe Reed. And but more importantly, listen to my podcast. It's called This Had Oscar Buzz. We have a very good time with movies that didn't get Oscar success. I also am devising the new game at Vulture called Cinematrix, which is a 3x3 grid game that we're trying to make as fun and challenging in equal measure as it can possibly be. And that is a formula that is ever tinkering, but we're having a very good time with that.
Our editor and producer is Brett Fuchs, and this week's award for the best description of how we feel affectionately about our producer, Brett, after he cuts together all these clips for this episode, goes to Joe Reed.
You just want to sort of, like, give him a noogie or something like that. I don't know.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. The jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
From PRX.